This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an on-the-ground perspective from last week's historic march in Jena, Louisiana. We'll hear an update on the case of the Cuban Five. Last month, oral arguments were heard in Atlanta, Georgia, before a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. You have no rights, according to Matthew Rothschild.
Well, that's the title of his book, and you know, we have some rights. Not that many anymore, and getting less. And he tells stories about what Bush and the company's been doing since 9/11.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
The nation's most closely watched cases, the so-called Jena Six, a judge on Friday denied a request to release on bail Michael Bell, the teenager whose arrest in the beating of a white classmate sparked last week's historic civil rights protest in Louisiana. 17-year-old Bell was convicted of aggravated second-degree battery, which could have led to 15 years in prison. But his conviction was thrown out by a state appeals court that said he could not be tried as an adult, because he was 16 at the time of the incident. At a separate closed hearing on Friday, a judge refused a defense request to remove Judge J.P. Mauffre Jr. from Bell's case. This case dates back to August 2006, when black Jena High School students sat under a shade tree that was a frequent gathering place for whites. After nooses appeared in the tree the next day, three white students were suspended but not criminally prosecuted. The incident was followed by fights between blacks and whites that culminated in the attack on Justin Barker, who was knocked unconscious on school grounds. According to court testimony, his face was swollen and bloodied, but he was able to attend a school function that night. Five of the teens were originally charged with attempted second-degree murder, charges that have since been reduced for four of them. The sixth was booked as a juvenile on sealed charges. Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Eugene Puryear about this Jena 6 case. Eugene is a Howard University student and a key national political organizer for Jena 6. He's recently back from the protest in Louisiana. Welcome, Eugene, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on, Heidi.
I know it's been a busy last few weeks for you, and we really appreciate your joining us last minute. We'd like to talk first, before we hear about your involvement and what actually happened down in Louisiana, about the most recent developments. This last Friday, we learned that the judge presiding over Michael Bell's case denied bail pending appeal. That's a major disappointment right on the heels of the historic march. Can you tell us what plans you and the movement have?
Well, I think, you know, our plans now are really going to be to kick it into high gear. I know a lot of people had a lot of hopes up, hoping Michael Bell would be released, and of course he should be released. And, you know, I think the actions of both the judge and the district attorney and the people down there is, you know, just to further criminalize Michael Bell and make him seem like he's some sort of danger to the community. And so, you know, in talking with students at Howard University and across the country, really, people are going back to their hometowns and they're going to get right back into organizing. People are going to be organizing protests in different places, forums. I've even heard talk of some sit-ins and different things like that. But what we want to do is now we want to turn up the heat a little bit and say free Michael Bell and drop the charges on the Jena 6. But that the fact that, you know, there is money for his bail and it's, you know, continually being denied is just completely outrageous. And our goal is to just make it impossible for these people to continue these injustices without some sort of action going on around the country, not just in Jena on one day.
The bail was originally set at $90,000. Has that been reduced?
It has been reduced to a number that is not 100% clear, because there's a lot of rumors floating around. So I don't want to say a particular number, because when I was down there, there's a lot of people saying it was this number, it was that number. And so, you know, no one seems to really know 100% what the deal is now, and especially since his charges have supposedly been dropped to juvenile charges, there's a lot of different things swirling around it.
Let's start back, Eugene, by telling our listeners how you became involved in the case and what your role as an organizer has been.
I got involved in the case this past summer, in late June, or early July, rather, an article that was written by Bill Quigley, who's a lawyer down in Louisiana.
Yes, and a National Lawyers Guild member, I might add.
Yes, most certainly, and very active one at that. You know, I read that article. It was sent to me by Marv or Hayden Hilliard, in fact, another National Lawyers Guild member. And I saw it, and it just, he had listed in there that on July 31st, there was going to be the sentencing hearing for Michael Bell. And so my first reaction was, I got to be there, and I got to do whatever I can to get involved. So I reached out to some of the people who were organizing down in Jena. They were very excited to hear from me, of course, as a Howard student and an organizer in many different struggles. And I was able to go down there, thankfully, on the 31st and be involved in the first rally that happened in Jena, involving people from around the country. And from there, it just sort of carried on, and I came back to Howard for the fall semester, and a lot of students were very interested. And, you know, the momentum just started picking up, and, you know, we were meeting, you know, a couple times a week and just discussing everything we could do. So really, that's sort of how I got involved, is just going down there, you know, off of just being interested in doing something to stop this injustice.
You took the bus last week down from D.C.
Yes.
With thousands of others. I heard there were a few difficulties. Buses got stuck on the road, unable to get there. Did you have any problems?
You know, getting down there, we actually didn't have any problems. In fact, it was a long ride, but it was pretty smooth, and we got there very, very early, and so we were able to get in and unload. But some buses that came a little later, who had stopped the night before in Alexandria, they were sort of held up a little bit on the road for several hours and not really allowed to come through for reasons we were not explained. And then finally, right before the march started, it was about 6 or 7 buses that had been stuck on this road were allowed to come through and let people off. And thankfully, those people were able to join us on the march.
Now, tell us about the police presence, something we're always interested in. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of law enforcement officials?
Oh, most certainly. I mean, they were definitely trying to keep a lower profile, I think, than in a lot of demonstrations, because I think they were a little concerned about, you know, seeming like they're having a heavy hand. But there were quite a few plainclothes police and a lot of state troopers, because LaSalle Parish is very small, and Jena itself only has 3,000 people in it. And so there were far more people in Jena that day than even live in the town. And so they called in a lot of help from Louisiana State Police, who was basically managing the whole thing, you know, shutting down the highways and, you know, directing people here and there. So they were definitely around, and they were definitely sort of directing things. But what was sort of interesting about it is that inside of sort of they sort of almost sort of set up their perimeter. And inside of that, actually, there was sort of relative freedom of movement, which I think was really actually a testament to the fact that the movement was so strong that even, you know, the Louisiana State Police and the local sheriff's forces and things like that didn't want to do anything to really try to overtly challenge organizers and protesters.
That's wonderful. Now, didn't they declare a state of emergency?
You know, I heard that they did declare a state of emergency. And see, the thing was, most people who lived in Jena actually, and most 85% of those people are white, actually left the town and the day before. And so the police presence was really more of like a managing presence, because there was very little interaction between residents of Jena and the marchers itself, because they were just very little there. But I think they were very worried, because the officials in that area had never seen anything like that before. And so for them, you know, they wanted to take precautions for whatever reason that make it seem like they were sort of in control.
Did anything notable happen we should know about?
Yeah, I think, you know, on two sides, some notable things happened. On the one side, for the protesters, I think just what happened is very notable. And a lot of the people from down there were from Louisiana. And I think that's important, because a lot of people are, and especially even some people in Jena, want to portray this as just traditionally how this is portrayed, as like these so-called outside agitators coming in, regardless of the fact that no matter where people came from, they definitely had a reason to be there, whether they came from New York, Chicago, D.C. But there was many, many, many local people. And I was very excited to see a lot of people from New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Shreveport, Alexandria, who were out there, who just felt so strongly because in their towns they had seen so many things like this before and had come out and were really protesting. And it was the community as a whole that was out there and down there. And then something I also think is notable is that racist forces while they mobilized, they were kept by the police sort of far away from us. But something I think people should be aware of is that, and the story is around on the internet, that a white supremacist group actually published the addresses of all of the Gina Six and urged the people reading these websites to deliver, you know, some sort of vigilante justice against these families. And so I think it's important for people around the country to know, even though it's 2007, there's, of course, a lot of institutionalized racism, but that racist forces are mobilizing and that they do oppose what we're doing. And we need to be very, very vigilant about what happens in Gina to make sure that there aren't any tragedies.
That's a chilling observation, but you're absolutely right. In the National Lawyers Guild, we've been discussing the case, and one of the points is that really we have to get the case out of that small town and either into a federal jurisdiction or... I heard that the same judge is really the only judge in that parish, that he presided over Michael Bell's case in adult court, presided over the bail hearing, and that if it goes to juvenile court as well, he'll preside there. So it's really a case of small town justice, as it were.
Oh, very much so, very much so. I mean, it's a very small town, and this guy, D.A. Reed Walters, and the people from Gina, the black population, they'll tell you that, you know, all the time there are different sorts of racist outrages. And so I really agree with that. I mean, if it stays in Gina, I mean, look at what happened to Michael Bell with the jury and the DA and the public defender. Clearly, there's no one in that town that's involved in the legal system, you know, in that sense, that is going to stand up for these young men. And I think it has to go somewhere where they at least have a chance of getting a fair hearing.
I read that this judge appeared with armed sheriff's guards at the school. That would be Gina High School, and declared to the white students that he could destroy their lives, quote, with the stroke of a pen, and that he also advised the school board when it was considering expelling the Gina Six that they couldn't ask any substantive questions or look at the investigation file from the school administration.
What had happened was the black students, actually, after the nooses was hung, they actually decided to have a sit-in under the tree the day after that to protest the nooses, and that's when Reed Walters came and had a school assembly and said, there can be no more disturbances, and, you know, if you do something, you know, I can take your life away with the stroke of a pen.
I'm curious, have the parents of the white students involved made any public statements or...
At first, it was like they were non-existent, and I think they were sort of maybe even being held under wraps. But in recent days, I don't think it was the parents per se, but some people in the family have come out and appeared at various times with the DA, and they're certainly on the side of what the DA is doing and sort of stressing, or at least attempting to stress the fact that, you know, they claim they are not racist people and that it is not a racist town and that this is justice and it's only fair that, you know, these young men are being jailed and investigated.
Did you or other protesters have any interactions with the families?
Not of Justin Barker, I believe his name, who is the so-called victim.
Right.
But I've actually been able to talk several times with a few of the family members of the Gina Six.
I think what's so remarkable to the producers of Law and Disorder, our listeners, is, as we said earlier, how such a large number of people mobilized so relatively quickly. This really brings up, you know, the historical civil rights movement and injustices. And for us, it's so exciting to see public attention and public awareness really raised. This has received so much media attention of late. I mean, it's taken a while, but would you say that in the last month or two, you've seen an exponential increase in attention, or has it been growing all year long?
I would say I've seen an exponential increase. I mean, it flew under the radar for so long that, you know, when I was first down there on July 31st, there was 250 of us, and there were tens of thousands of people, and really it's sort of been exciting to see as an organizer how, as people learn about it, they immediately are like, what can we do? I mean, we have to do something, and people just feel that spirit. And I think what it is that, you know, a lot of people, particularly black people and young black people, the rights that were won historically for us are sort of being, or not seeming, but are being stripped away, whether slowly or quickly, all over the place and around the country. And this case has really sort of tapped into that sentiment, because it's a perfect example of everything that is wrong with the justice system and how, even after so many years of fighting, here is the situation that black America is still in 2007. And that feeling is just so strong in people and so disgusting in people that we still have to be fighting, you know, over things like this that, you know, for so many people have died and gone to jail over for so many years, that all, you know, people have just been, as they learn about it, sort of swelling up. And it's really been swelling up from the bottom. And it was really, really the grassroots out there last week.
Do you think there's a chance of another large march on Gina?
You know, I don't know if one's going to happen in Gina. I think if there was one called, it would happen. And I think that anywhere anyone calls a national march of any sort, people will come. Because a lot of people, since they went down there and now Michael Bell has not been let free, I think are more than willing to continue the fight. And from everyone I talk to, from Howard, from D.C., from around the country, you know, the main thing on people's minds is, let's not let this go when we get home. Let's keep this going. And so I think there's definitely a chance something else could go in Gina or in Baton Rouge directed at the governor or in Washington, D.C. directed at the Justice Department. And I think that, you know, the authorities down there and progressive people should definitely be on the lookout for those sorts of things, because I think there's going to be a lot more action happening on this case.
And a multi-level effort is often extremely successful. You're now what year at Howard University?
I'm a senior this year.
A very politically active senior. Do you have plans for graduation, law school perhaps?
Right now, I'm thinking about pursuing a career as a high school teacher.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
And I think you'd be a great role model.
Oh, well, thank you.
Tell us, Eugene, if people want to get involved, how can they help?
Well, there's a few things you can do. First and foremost, people should definitely try to donate money any way they can. The easiest way that a lot of people have been donating is the NAACP website has a link on there. But also there is a blog, if you Google it, it's Friends of Justice, run by a guy, Alan Bean, who's based out of Texas, who's been there from the very beginning working on this case and has done a lot of hard work, and he has ways to donate on his website as well. For people who are looking to get involved in, you know, an activist way, wherever you are, but particularly for people in New York, because I know we're on WBAI, please just get in contact with us at the Answer Coalition, because we're not going to let this go. We're going to, you know, keep pushing, and we want to make a big push on this now that Michael Bell has not been released. And you, of course, can reach us at our website, which is answercoalition.org. Or if you're in New York, you can call us at 212-694-8720.
Al Sharpton's National Action Network also has information.
Yes, yes. Please visit their website. I'm sure they're going to be doing quite a bit. They were down there last week as well.
Eugene, it's been a pleasure to have you with us, especially since I know you've been so busy and you probably have some schoolwork to attend to.
Oh, well, no worry. The pleasure is all mine.
But if you go down again or if something else happens, we'd love to have you join us again.
Oh, most certainly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
In a recent powerful breakthrough in the case of the Cuban Five, Colin Powell's chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, recently commented that he is stunned by the travesty of what has happened to the Cuban Five. This is important in that the case has received so little public attention in the United States. This is Heidi Boghossian. Last month, I attended the oral arguments in the case of the Five, presided over by a 3-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. A host of international supporters, including prominent jurists from Ecuador, Germany, Italy, Brazil, Canada, England, and other countries, were there. Former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney also attended, along with representatives from the National Lawyers Guild, the American Association of Jurists, and the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. We go now to hear part of an interview with the National Lawyers Guild radio show on our sister affiliate, KPFK in Los Angeles. Host Jim Lafferty talks with attorney Len Wineglass, one of the lawyers for the Five, just days before the oral argument. Let's have a listen.
And tell us about the conditions under which these men are being held.
Well, first, after their arrest, they had no history of violence or weaponry. They were put isolation for 17 months prior to their trial. The documents that were taken from them upon their arrest were all stamped top secret, their own documents, and then put into a special confinement area in the basement of the prison, where their lawyers had access, but only after making an appointment and signing in and going to a room, into a room where they were filed and examining their own client's documents with a guard present.
My goodness, yeah.
That continued until their conviction, and then they were separated. One was sent to California, one to Colorado, one to Wisconsin, one to upstate New York, who's now in South Carolina, and one to Texas. They couldn't be more completely separated if you look at a map of the United States.
Right, I've seen that, yeah.
So if you as an attorney would want to consult with your five clients, you would have to take a couple weeks off and fly from place to place. Never had the opportunity of seeing them together.
Yes.
But then something happened after 9/11. They took all five and put them in a special isolation status, which in the case of Gerardo Hernandez, who's in California, they put him in something called the concrete box, which is a place in the basement, no windows, of course. It's all concrete. They took all of his clothes from him. All of his books and papers were taken from him. And they put a sign that no one was allowed to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed in a state of complete deprivation, sensory deprivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was the first to see him after almost 30 days. Mm. And he was completely disoriented by that.
Oh, my gosh.
We threatened litigation over that. There was a worldwide reaction to it, and the Bureau of Prison was inundated with letters of protest, and after 30 days, they returned them all to prison. The five have pretty much done almost 45 years now, collectively in prison, and there hasn't been a single write-up or disciplinary infraction against them.
Leonard, earlier you won a victory in the Federal Appeals Court in Atlanta on this case. Then it was overturned after hearing before the entire panel. Next week, the 20th, I think it is going to be another court hearing in Atlanta of an appeal in the case of the Cuban Five. Can you tell our listeners what the main legal issues are that are on appeal now?
Yes, this is the third time the case will be argued on appeal. No one can recall a case that has been argued three times on appeal. It's almost as if the system is having difficulty digesting this injustice.
I should think.
The first time we argued on appeal before a three-judge panel, three very eminent and experienced federal judges with approximately 80 years of judicial experience between the three, they ruled after 16 months of examining this record of 119 volumes, 20,000 pages of exhibits in addition, they ruled unanimously in a 93-page opinion that the five did not receive a fair trial in Miami, and they reversed all the convictions. That was in August of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez then directed the U.S. attorneys in Miami to seek en banc a full court review of that decision. That's very unusual because it was a unanimous decision.
Yes.
With a very long and very scholarly written opinion. The 11th Circuit en banc, which is the entire court of 12 judges, then agreed over our objection to review the case. We argued the case a second time on the issue of venue only.
Uh-huh.
Before the en banc court, and on the first anniversary of the decision that reversed the case, the en banc court in August of 2006 reversed the panel.
And reinstated.
And reinstated all the convictions. But having done that, they remanded the remaining issues that were never decided.
Yes.
And that were raised on the first go-around back to the panel. So that's where we are now. We're back before our original panel, minus one judge.
Is it still just the two judges? I thought I'd heard they might now have appointed a third, no?
We have just been informed this week that there is a third judge
who's
been named. So we're back before three judges.
Two of whom found in your favor before on the issue of venue, right?
That's correct.
Now, what are the issues, though? Is it now going to be the full panoply of issues that you're arguing?
Yes. All the remaining issues.
What would you say? I know there are about nine of them, but what would you say are the most important or significant issues that you're going to be arguing next week?
Well, there you could prioritize it down to three. The main issue is the count that alleges a conspiracy to commit murder against one of the five, Gerardo Hernandez, that count, we are arguing, should be dismissed for a failure of the evidence. And we have, in support of our position, a petition that the government filed at the end of the trial asking the appellate court to review the prospective instruction the judge was about to give the jury, because they claim that if that instruction were given, the government faces an insurmountable obstacle, that was the phrase they used, to gaining a conviction because they just didn't have the evidence. The circuit refused to intervene. The judge instructed the jury on that instruction.
Gave them what they wanted, in other
words. Yes, and the Miami jury convicted nonetheless. So I think that count should go. That eliminates one life sentence. The remaining life sentences are on the count that alleges a conspiracy to commit espionage, and we argue that count should be returned for a new trial because of the prosecutorial misconduct of the prosecutor in making his closing argument to the jury. Well, we submitted to the appellate court a whole volume setting forth all the various themes that the prosecutor used in making a highly prejudicial and improper final argument to the jury. To give you an example, Jim, as I've said several times, the five in this country did not do any harm, did not injure anyone, were not armed,
right.
No explosives, no sabotage. The prosecutor in his final argument to the Miami jury said that the five came to the United States, to use his very words, to destroy the United States. And he said that not once. He said it three times. And as you know, a prosecutor is permitted a great leeway in making a final argument. You can quote the Bible, you can analogize it to moments of history, etc. But one thing you can't do is you can't introduce evidence that's never been introduced in
right,
the record.
Right.
And to say that they came to destroy the United States, and there's no evidence whatsoever of that or that activity, is just outside the bounds of fair comment.
One would hope.
Yes. And we would hope that that in and of itself would be enough to reverse
yeah,
the
case. Now, you mentioned there's a third major issue as well, an appeal.
Yes, the third issue is that even if they accept the fact that that is not prosecutorial misconduct and they uphold the convictions on the conspiracy to commit espionage, the sentencing was outside the bounds of what is permitted, the sentencing for this kind of a situation where no top secret information was ever gathered or sent to Cuba. And yet they were sentenced as if that were the case.
Yeah.
And they were also sentenced as if the conspiracy had completed its object. In other words, that espionage had actually occurred. And there was no evidence of that either.
No.
And so the judge maxed them out on both of those prongs of the guidelines, which we argue was just highly in violation of the guidelines and improper for the judge to do. So even if the conviction remains, the sentence has to come way down.
I got you.
And they've already served 9 years.
Leonard, well, guys, as I mentioned earlier, you've handled certainly some of the, well, some of the highest profile and most significant politically charged criminal defense cases in the country. What role in a case like this does the kind of work that Gloria is doing in the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five? Certainly the case has got to be won or lost ultimately in the courtroom, but how important is it to have this kind of support, this broad support in the country and now around the world?
Well, a lawyer can only argue in a courtroom or submit a written brief. Whether that brief is read, whether the advocate is listened to, whether the case is taken seriously, really, in my experience, depends upon the extensive amount of public interest and support in the case. It's always been true. It was true for Angela Davis. It was true for the Chicago 8. It's been true throughout my own experience, and so the expression of support is very critical to succeeding in a political trial.
That's an excerpt from an interview with attorney Len Wineglass on the National Lawyers Guild radio show on sister affiliate KPFK Radio. In his recently published book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression, Matthew Rothschild, an editor of the Progressive magazine, cites dozens of personal stories that outline the big picture of repression in the United States. Hired goon squads of young Republicans shout down protesters with USA chants. Remember the lawyer who was arrested at a local mall for wearing a Give Peace a Chance t-shirt? As Rothschild points out in his new book, the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments are under siege, and very little is being done to protect them.
Matt Rothschild, you're from Madison, Wisconsin, where I spent 6 good years in the 60s, and I'm a loyal and appreciative reader of The Progressive, which you've worked on for a couple dozen years and edited for most of those. It's just a pleasure to have you on the show. We wanted to talk to you about the book that you've just written, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. So welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Matthew, we wanted to start by mentioning that in the book you cite essentially 5 large ways that the Bush administration has taken away our civil liberties since 9/11. There are things that we've covered extensively on this show, most of them, the Ashcroft raids, abuse of the material witness statute, enemy combatants, extraordinary renditions, the dissolution of the Levi guidelines, and eavesdropping on lawyer-inmate conversations. Could you briefly talk about how that forms the structure of the book?
Yeah, what I do in this book is in the first chapter, I talk about what I call the edifice of repression that Bush and Cheney have erected brick by brick here in the last 6 or 7 years, because it's important to understand that there is this structure of repression that we're living under, and it's also important for all of us who want to restore our civil liberties and civil rights to take down this edifice of repression, not only so Bush and Cheney can't keep using it, but so the next president or the next one can't keep using it. And then what I do in the book is tell 82 stories of individuals whose rights have been violated. But look, we're not keeping our eye on the ball enough in this country on this structure, this edifice of repression that Bush and Cheney have brought down systematically since 9/11. We had Ashcroft rounding up, really in a way that we hadn't seen since the Japanese internment camps during World War II, rounding up people because of their race or nationality, and then exporting people, expelling people from this country in a way, 5,000 people, a way that we haven't seen since the McCarthy period. That's one thing we need to be clear on. The other is kind of the legal apparatus that's been set up for detaining people indefinitely in this country. And one of those is the material witness statute that was put on the books to keep witnesses in mafia cases from fleeing, from going, you know, to another country. And so you'd hold them as a material witness and protect them there so that they wouldn't leave the country when you needed their testimony at trial. Now this material witness statute is being systematically abused by the Bush administration and by prosecutors to hold for months and months on end anyone that they can't find any crime to charge them with. So these people are being held, detained against their wishes, and not being charged with any crime. I mean, that's not what's supposed to happen in this country. And then, of course, you have the extraordinary renditions, a term I don't like to use. What I call this is the disappearances, because we have Bush and Cheney acting really like an Argentinian junta right now. They torture people. They send people overseas and make them disappear. They invade another country, and they act like they have no impunity whatsoever. This idea that you can grab someone in the United States or anywhere else in the world and then send them to a secret CIA prison somewhere or send them to a client state that has an expertise in torture, I mean, that should be anathema to any Americans. And then, you know, labeling people enemy combatants, which now the administration can do and any president subsequent can do because of the virtue of the Military Commissions Act, which passed last fall, the president now has the right to label any of us an enemy combatant, even if we're U.S. citizens, just as they did to Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla. And if you're not a U.S. citizen, under the statute now you're labeled an alien enemy combatant, and you can be tossed in jail and never have the right to see a judge or a lawyer again.
Yeah, that's what is so alarming to us, that they've really changed the rules that have been central to American jurisprudence for a couple hundred years and really go all the way back to the Magna Carta, and all done under the rubric of the War on Terror. The decision, of course, is pending in the Supreme Court about whether they can wipe out habeas corpus. It's coming up in December. Given the lineup at the Supreme Court, there's cause to worry. And in the meantime, there's these atrocities that keep being committed around the country. And I'd like to get to that in a second. But please finish up on the brick-by-brick edifice of the repression they're building. And then let's talk about some of the individual stories that you catalog so beautifully in your book, Matthew Rothschild's book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America and an Age of Repression. Matt, finish up on this brick-by-brick description of what they've done first, and then let's get into some of the details.
Okay, well, I'll go quickly through a couple more. Edward Levy guidelines, these were guidelines that the Attorney General Edward Levy in a Republican administration in 1976 under Gerald Ford put in place that said the police do not have a right to go out in public to a protest and start taking notes on the protest or filming the protesters unless there's overwhelming evidence that there's criminal activity happening there. And what Ashcroft did was just completely repeal that, so that now, you know, at almost every protest we go to, we see police with their camcorders on their shoulders filming the protesters who are doing nothing illegal, simply exercising their First Amendment rights, and yet their files being made of them. That is truly reprehensible. And then here's something that didn't get a lot of coverage anywhere, really. The fact that the Bush administration says it's now legal for the prosecutors to be listening in on lawyer prisoner conversations as long as the government says they're related to terrorism. Well, what good is a lawyer-prisoner confidentiality if the prosecutor, the people who are going to be pressing the case against the prisoner or the client before the person is in prison, if the prosecutors can listen in and hear everything? I mean, that's just turning over your cards as a defense attorney to the government. That's outrageous. The USA Patriot Act, that's a huge thing. A lot of people know about that. Unfortunately, the revised Patriot Act did not improve on the original in the ways that people thought. People think now, well, maybe libraries and bookstores are exempted. Actually, not. Libraries aren't exempted at all if a library has a computer that people can use, and almost every library does now. I mean, that's ridiculous. So now they can go into the library and still ask for whoever was a customer of that library and what books they were checking out or what computers they were using, and the librarian has to give that information to the FBI, and then the librarian can't talk about it, with one exception. Now they are guaranteed the right to talk to an attorney, which was unclear before.
Great.
Unbelievable as that is, but still, people's rights in the library are not secure anymore. Well, no, I think about the signing statements that Bush has done where he signs a bill rather than veto it. He puts a little asterisk there and says, I'm going to enforce this only to the extent that it doesn't interfere with the way I read the Constitution or the way I construe my powers as Commander-in-Chief. That's not one of the options in our system, but Bush has taken it.
We're supposed to have a separation of powers here. You know, you have that wonderful quote that you start off your first chapter, The Edifice of Repression, from our long-gone Attorney General John Ashcroft, and you quote him saying, "To those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message to you is this. Your tactics only aid terrorists. They give ammunition to America's enemies and pause to America's friends." Phantoms of lost liberties? Let's talk about some of these phantoms. You've got a 200-some page book describing various people who've lost their liberties. And some of these stories are, I hate to say it, they're even amusing. But what sticks out in your mind in terms of some of the stories you'd like to recount to our listeners?
Well, thanks, Michael. I mean, I think the one that almost everybody can relate to immediately is the case of Mark Schultz, who was down in Atlanta, Georgia in 2003 at a time where a new Harry Potter book was coming out. He works at a bookstore. It's a Saturday. He knows he's going to need a lot of caffeine to get through the day, so he goes to Caribou Coffee before the bookstore opens. He's standing in line there, and he's reading an article that his father has downloaded off the web called Weapons of Mass Stupidity. It's an article about Fox News. How Fox is just a propaganda organ for war and for the Bush administration. Well, evidently, somebody else standing in the line there at Caribou Coffee didn't think it was as funny as you think it is, Michael, because 3 days later, the FBI show up at Mark Schultz's bookstore, and they say, "Were you at Caribou Coffee 3 days ago?" And he says, "Yes, I was. Why?" "Well, we understand you were reading some left-wing editorial there." No, you get in trouble, you get a visit from the FBI for reading a left-wing editorial in America. As someone who writes left-wing editorials, I find that offensive, but even more so as a U.S. citizen, I find that appalling.
Are there any other similar stories that you want to share with us?
Well, there was a story of a guy named Joe Prevetera, who in Boston was outraged at the U.S. torture scandal at Abu Ghraib, and so a couple weeks after that, he and a couple of peace activists, human rights activists, decided to protest against it. So they got a cart and went onto the Boston Commons, or right near there, outside a military recruiting station. And he dressed up, Joe did, as the iconic Abu Ghraib detainee, the guy with the black hood on and the black poncho, who was forced to stand on a crate. And that guy had little pieces of electricity attached to his hands because he was falsely executed. That was one of the ways that they were torturing. And so Joe Prevetera affixed to his fingers a couple inches of stereo wire to demonstrate that they were trying to pretend that they were executing this man to incite terror in him. And so they stood out there, and they were getting hassled by the people at the military recruiting station. And soon the military recruiters called the cops, and the cops arrived, and they were getting a little belligerent. So the peace activist told Joe, maybe it's time for you to get off the crate and take the costume off and go. And so he stepped down, he took his hood off, and started to walk away, and the police said, "You can't do that." And he said, "Why?" "You're under arrest." And do you know what they arrested him for? For making a bomb threat. They alleged that the couple inches of stereo wires on his fingers constituted a bomb threat. They held him overnight, and they told him, the Boston police officers did, to stop reading those communist newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times, because our guys over there in Iraq are doing a lot of good.
And Matthew, that, as well as the many other incidents that you document, tell us a bit about how you came to write this book and the people that you met or interviewed. I know you have a web column, McCarthyism Watch, chronicling incidents of repression. Were emails instrumental in?
Yeah, it's really amazing. Once I started on this story, and I never let go, I got fed a lot of these. I mean, I found some by going to websites from, like, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and thoroughly going over their press releases and statements. But also, people would feed me things. Like, I was fed the story of this guy, Steve Howards, who just last summer was in Beaver Creek, Colorado. He was taking his 8-year-old son to Suzuki piano lessons. He's walking across the open-air mall there, and who is there but Dick Cheney? Dick Cheney is shaking people's hands. It's a conservative town. It's near Vail. Anyway, Steve Howards goes up to the vice president with his son and says, "Mr. Vice President, I think your policies on Iraq are reprehensible." And then he walks away with his son. A couple minutes later, the Secret Service approached him and said, "Did you just assault the Vice President of the United States?" And Steve Howard said, "No, I'm just trying to exercise my rights here." "No, you assaulted the Vice President of the United States, and you're under arrest for assaulting the Vice President of the United States." They grabbed his arms behind his back and handcuffed him in front of his 8-year-old boy, and Steve Howard says, "What's going to happen to my son here?" And they said, "Well, social services can take care of him." Fortunately, the boy's mother was around and was able to take care of him. But that's just incredible. You can't talk back to the vice president without being arrested for assault.
You've got another story about going to a Bush rally, but let me first remind our listeners, we're talking with Matthew Rothschild. He's written this wonderful book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. You have no rights. Matthew, tell us what happens if you happen to go to a Bush rally.
You know, a guy got not only arrested, but convicted for going to a Bush rally, and I think a lot of your listeners can relate to this man. His name is Brett Bercy. He's head of the Peace and Social Justice Coalition down in South Carolina, and Bush was visiting Columbia, South Carolina, the airport there at the Capitol, to do some campaigning for Lindsey Graham. And there were a lot of people at the airport who had pro-Bush signs and pro-Lindsey Graham signs, but not Brett Bercy. He had a sign that said, no more war for oil. And the Secret Service and local police came up to him, not to the pro-Bush people, not to the pro-Lindsey Graham people, but up to Brett Bercy and said, you got to leave here. You can't be here. He said, well, I've got a First Amendment right to be here. And they said, no, you got to go to the free speech zone a half mile or a mile away. And Brett Bercy, bless his heart, he said, I thought America was a free speech zone. Well, America wasn't a free speech zone there in Columbia, South Carolina, because they arrested him for trespassing. And then the local DA eventually dropped the charges, but then amazingly, the U.S. prosecutor in South Carolina with the name and the identity of Strom Thurmond Jr., son of the hideous segregationist senator, pressed charges against Brett Bercy for violating the assassination and other threats against the president statute, and they got a conviction. He was fined $500.
Ah,
jeez. David Cole, our friend and often a guest on the show, said about your book, if you ever told yourself, this couldn't happen to me, read this book. Matt Rothschild, what kind of stuff are the Bushies doing to students who are students like you and me and Heidi on campuses these days?
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, this is back. We're going back to the days of Counsel Pro. We're going back to where the police and the feds have undercover people at our rallies. I mean, this shouldn't be happening, but it is. I mean, at Drake University, for instance, in Des Moines, Iowa, and I was out in Des Moines recently, there was, as far back as 2003, in November 2003, which gives you a sense as to how long we've been doing this peace activism, there was a peace conference there on campus sponsored by the National Lawyers Guild local chapter, and they were saying, you know, bring our troops home, bring our National Guard home. Well, that rally was infiltrated by sheriff's deputies who were there undercover. And at that rally, evidently the prosecutors weren't happy that peace activists were doing their thing, including people from Catholic peace ministries and Quakers. So the local DA started to issue subpoenas to everybody under the sun, including the National Lawyers Guild, including to Drake, with gag orders attached to the subpoenas. And fortunately, the protesters there were able to make enough noise about this prosecutorial excess that the prosecutor withdrew the subpoenas.
And they, Matthew, they asked for our membership lists, the guild membership
list. Yeah,
you must
know all about that, Heidi, because they did. They asked for who was attending, who were the members of the local National Lawyers Guild. Isn't that incredible?
It's incredible. And luckily, we filed a motion to, as they say, quash the subpoena, and were successful. But it was front page news on the New York Times and other publications. And luckily, you know, all civil libertarians were up in arms about it. But it's just a little example of what they've been doing, as you say. You cite some examples of how some of the individuals you've profiled have actually stood up for their rights after they were violated. Can you give us a couple of examples of what they've done?
Yeah, I mean, I do think anyone who thinks that your rights have been violated, you should contact either the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or a good defense lawyer and challenge that, as a lot of people in this book have challenged it, and people have prevailed, and that's been gratifying. I think the most famous couple that has prevailed are Nicole and Jeff Rank. They were arrested, of all dates, July 4th. It was July 4th, 2004. They were at the Capitol in West Virginia, and they had signs out there. Bush was there at the Capitol talking. And again, on Capitol grounds, people were selling paraphernalia, you know, pro-Bush paraphernalia, T-shirts, buttons, etc. Well, Nicole and Jeff Rank didn't have a pro-Bush shirt on. They had an anti-Bush shirt on. They actually had the name Bush in a circle on their T-shirt with a diagonal line through it, the international sign for No Bush, and on the back of one of their shirts that said Love America, Hate Bush. And like what happened to Brett Bercy, the same thing happened to them. The local police with Secret Service came up and said, you can't be there. They sat down. They were arrested for trespassing. But eventually the city dropped charges, and there wasn't a Strom Thurmond Jr. there to prosecute him further. In any event, they sued. They sued the White House Office of Advance. And they got a settlement recently for $80,000. But more importantly, they got, through the ACLU, which pushed the suit, they got a document from the White House Office of Advance that was a document on how to suppress dissent. It told members of the Office of Advance that you have to do whatever you can to try to exclude demonstrators from any event where the vice president and president are there. And if protesters somehow managed to get in. It is your job to gather up what they call a rally squad, and what I think you and I would call a goon squad, to stand in front of the people who have the signs and block those signs from the president's view, the vice president's view, the audience's view, the media's view. And if the protesters chant something, it is the job of the rally squad to drown them out with chants. The White House office manual of advance, the advance manual, tells them what chant to say. They should chant USA, USA, USA.
You know,
isn't that incredible?
Yeah. I've just been reading a book by Naomi Wolf called Letter to a Young Patriot. And her first chapter, she talks about these kinds of things that you just mentioned. She calls them historical echoes. And they are echoes of Nazi Germany. It was scary when the Bush people went down and stopped a recount of the vote in Florida. They did the same kind of tactics. And what you've just described is similar. Matthew Rothschild, he's the editor of the Progressive magazine, which we would hope all of our listeners subscribe to. He's written an excellent book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. I just wanted to read one thing that Howard Zinn said about your book, Matthew. Rothschild demonstrates how the war in Iraq has also been a war on our liberties. The stories he tells add up to a powerful indictment of our political leaders, but they also remind us as citizens that we must insist on taking back our stolen rights.
Matthew, where can listeners contact you if they want to share stories?
Yeah, they can contact me at editorial@progressive.org. editorial@progressive.org. That's the email here that I check every day, so I'd be glad to hear from people.
And the book is published by the New Press if people want to read it, which we encourage listeners to do.
You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Matthew Rothschild, thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Michael and Heidi, it's been my pleasure.
Take
Bye-bye.
It easy.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.